Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. January 3rd, 2017. It's a new year. Lots of great topics lined up for this year. Many in the month of January that will help us take a look at the issues of life with the upcoming March for Life, the LCMS Life Conference, the Liberty Conference for our college students going on this week as well in Washington, D.C. Lots of important topics to discuss this month. And well, we welcome your input as well. If you have questions, comments, something you'd like for us to discuss on Faith and Family, send me an email, family@kfuo.org. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. Find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining me by phone this morning, Dr. Priscilla Coleman. She's professor of human development and family studies at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. Dr. Coleman, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you, Andy. It's great to be here.
Glad to have some time to chat with you this morning about your work and also what's going on in the world of medical research and scientific research. And you wrote a recent critique on the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. They had a recent article back in December on a very important topic, research on abortion and mental health. And we're going to get to that in just a little bit. Tell me, though, before we get to that, about your work at Bowling Green State University. You're on break right now, so not a lot of papers to grade right now, and probably enjoying some peace and quiet for the moment.
I'm feeling the time ticking away, but I've been teaching at Bowling Green for 16 years now, and I'm a full professor. I teach classes in development across the lifespan. I teach research methods. I supervise student research projects, and I have a student load of close to 200 students each semester. So once the semester gets rolling, that's pretty much what I'm doing. But I also, as part of my professional responsibilities, I've had to engage in research in order to be tenured and to be promoted to full professor. And my research has been really on all reproductive outcomes. I've studied childbirth and the adjustment to parenting, attachment type issues. I've studied recently, looked at adoption from the birth mother's perspective, but most of my research has been on the psychological implications of abortion. And I've published over 50 journal articles. So I use my summers and the Christmas break to, get ahead with a lot of that. So
what
I
is
don't
it?
Really stop too often.
What is it about this field of human development and family studies that drew you in, that you wanted to study this and to teach this as well?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, my training is all in psychology. I have a PhD in lifespan developmental psychology. I taught in a psych curriculum at the University of the South for 4 years. But human development and family studies is attractive to me and attractive to many people because it is interdisciplinary. We have faculty members who are trained in psych. We've had sociology. We've had social work. It just, the discipline is informed by so many different areas. Mm-hmm. And with the focus really being on how we develop from conception to death, what are all the issues physically, psychologically, socially, and then looking at how families function as a system within a culture across the lifespan as well. And so it's more applied. Psychology is more research-based, and I appreciate the training I received. It was strong in terms of the quantitative, methodological aspects of my work. But I feel more comfortable, I guess, in a human development and family studies program. The people I work with locally and outside of Bowling Green just seem more open-minded or something than psychology. There are a lot of biases that frame the discipline of psychology, and some of that will come out as we discuss this article.
Mm-hmm. So. You mentioned this is really an interdisciplinary program. How does your work shape future thinkers, leaders, and professionals? Who are the professionals that come through this program, and how does your work shape them?
Well, I teach basic courses in development, so the research that I do doesn't necessarily, it informs my teaching to some extent, but my teaching is much broader. then, you know, obviously the focus on pregnancy and abortion and adoption and so forth. But, you know, I try to, you know, I use examples from my work in that way. But I think it's kind of a tough question. I try to be a good role model to students. I try to be available to them on various levels. And all of the courses that I teach, I use the latest research to inform the lectures and so forth. So I think it's hard to really know how we're impacting this generation in the moment. But I often hear from students many years down the road, they appreciated the experience in the classroom and the foundation and research methods if they went on to grad school and so forth. But I think, you know, where I personally am having the most impact in the world relates to the publications and my work as an expert in state and civil cases involving abortion.
How do those publications, especially major medical journals, influence current professionals and future professionals, specifically in those areas of caring professions, psychology, psychiatry?
Well, the textbooks and, you know, all of the professional training, the initial training and the continued education training that professionals receive, it's all based on, or should be based on, journal articles primarily. And obviously practice involves, you know, being, you know, trained in the practical aspects, experience from more, you know, knowledgeable and seasoned professionals. You know, that's part of the training as well. But really the foundation of everything that professionals learn comes from the academic journals across various fields. So we rely on that information, and it needs to be based on solid science. And, you know, so that, you know, and unfortunately, part of that training that individuals receive involves training in research methodology. So if a, you know, a professional in training or someone who's in practice and receives the journal, reads the article, ideally, they have received adequate training in terms of the methods of science so that they can look at that and realize, you know, what the blatant flaws are. And then that, you know, that's likely to cause some significant dissonance, because we're relying on these journals and relying on these textbooks, yet we see such highly flawed research. And so there's got to be another explanation. And the only viable one is that this is, you know, motivated politically. And, you know, so it's scary. It really is.
Right. One of those journals is the Journal of the American Medical Association, also known as JAMA. And particularly JAMA Psychiatry is what we're talking about today. There was an article in the December 14th, titled "Women's Mental Health and Well-Being 5 Years After Being Denied an Abortion, a Prospective Longitudinal Cohort Study."
Now, right.
How you wrote a critique of this and stated, "Our culture is in a worrisome state when major medical journals ignore the foundation and methods of science in service to a political end." How so? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, it is scary if a political agenda is more important than providing the information we need to provide quality health care. We wouldn't want anybody performing heart surgery on us or prescribing medications that are based on faulty science. I mean, that's exactly what's happening here, because this journal is highly respected throughout the world. People will just look at the bottom line results. Professionals, clinicians are busy people, and they don't always have time to, you know, read through the sampling and all of the issues that may be present there to form their own opinion. They rely on those journal editors to have scrutinized the methodology and to only publish research that's credible with valid findings. And so, I've lost faith in these professional organizations that allow journals to get away with this stuff. And so, you know, that's what's scary about it. We're performing healthcare based on studies that are not science, simply not science.
How does this particular study, this article that written about this study, how does it approach the practice of abortion. The topic is women's mental health and well-being 5 years after being denied an abortion. How does it approach the topic or the practice of abortion in the United States?
Okay, well, I can kind of explain to you what they did. And there were admirable features. The fact that they followed women for 5 years, that's great. We have very few what we call prospective or longitudinal studies. The problem with their study is they lost like over three quarters of the sample, so that invalidated their conclusions. But just to back up a little bit, exactly what they did is they compared women relative to anxiety, depression, self-esteem, and life satisfaction. Women who had a first trimester abortion were compared with those that had an abortion just before the legal limit in the particular state, and those women who had were denied an abortion because they just missed that legal limit. And then those women either went on to give birth, or they may have had an abortion somewhere else or a miscarriage. So based on comparisons of those three groups, they concluded that those who were denied abortions had the poorest outcomes 1 week later. And what does 1 week later really mean? You know, they were denied what they were thinking they needed to have done at the moment, and they're probably still in crisis. But, you know, that was basically their results. When we conduct a study, we can't sample everyone in the population. Typically, there are some population-based studies, but there usually isn't, you know, and we don't have the resources, practical resources or financial to sample everyone in a country or everyone who's had an abortion. So what we do is we select a group from that population, and that's the sample. And the degree to which that sample represents the population is the foundation of any conclusions that we're able to draw. And the biggest issue with this study is it in no way represented women who typically have abortions. So I can kind of just go through what some of the big issues were. What I mentioned earlier was they initially asked lots of women to participate. Only 37.5 of those that were asked, you know, agreed to participate, and then they lost 42% throughout the study. So they were basically down to 22% of the original sample, and that 22%, those women were the ones they based their conclusions on. They also paid them, so the ones that stayed in the study received $350. That's considered kind of unethical because poor women will be unable to say no, so there's a coercive element there, and you're likely to get a biased sample if you're paying as well. They may be women who have more conflicted lives, difficulties on various levels if they're kind of desperate for that money. They made a statement in their conclusions indicating that the sample represented women who have an abortion. Well, demographically, if you just look at what, you know, the demographics, they, in their sample, it was 32% white, 32% black, and 36% mixed or other. And that compares to nationally in the U.S., 51% of the abortions are performed on white women, 41% on black, and 9% other. So it really doesn't even approximate women who have had abortions. So, and then another glaring problem with this study, huge, was how they measured anxiety and depression. Both of those outcomes were assessed with only six items, and there are all kinds of well-validated, stronger instruments with, you know, multiple you know, variables related to the different disorders. And it's six items really doesn't tell you anything. That's just not good science. And then when they also looked at self-esteem and life satisfaction with one single item. There isn't another topic in all of psychology or medicine that you could get a study published with such simplistic, superficial assessments. And they were so highly funded. It's ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that they didn't have better measures.
So basically,
and then another.
So what you're saying is that their assessment of life satisfaction or even depression was really based on just one question per topic?
Yeah, correct.
Are you depressed? I mean, it was something right. Like, I don't know what the actual question was.
Yeah,
but
no real clinical assessments here. And yet the headlines in newspapers across the country, across the world said abortion is not linked with mental health problems. Hello. And we really don't ever in science conclude anything based on one study because there are so many different variables or different, aspects of the sample that, another study may show a lack of support for a hypothesis. I'm always telling my students, don't even use the word prove because it doesn't prove anything. We provide support for a theory, for a hypothesis. And if we look at all of the literature on abortion and mental health, it overwhelmingly indicates that abortion significantly increases women's risk for having mental health problems. But we don't say it causes mental health problems. In some individual cases, it surely did cause the mental health problems. But the way that we measure these kinds of psychological variables, we just can't be that definitive because we can't manipulate somebody's reproductive history. We can't assign women to have an abortion or to have a birth. And the only way in science that we can really make those causal conclusions in a given study is when we randomly assign to conditions and then we follow the outcomes. And so, I testify in court all the time that the evidence indicates that women are at an increased risk and they deserve to be provided counseling and particularly when we have a whole other body of research indicating which women are most likely to have adverse consequences. We know that if they're having decisional distress, if they're ambivalent, if they're being pressured from others, if they feel that connection to the baby, if the pregnancy is more advanced, if they have prior mental health problems, if they believe the fetus is human, and 50% do, if they've had prior traumas. So we know so much about the risk factors. It's all in these journals throughout the world. And so, women need to be counseled effectively and substantively. Do they fall into a high-risk group? And then they need to be told that if they undergo the abortion, they may be looking at depression, suicide, ideation or actual suicide attempts. I was on a case in New Jersey with the young woman hung herself in her room after an abortion. And she was, she received the abortion through the Stephen Brigham's clinics in New Jersey. And she was told, part of my job was to evaluate the information that Stacy was provided and compare that to what was known in 2002. And she was in that fact sheet, they called it. She was literally told that it's common for women to have many abortions, some having over 20 abortions. This poor girl was told that by a supposed counselor and told that women who have abortions experience a sense of happiness and new hope and all these positive undocumented outcomes. And there literally is, virtually no study documenting positive effects of abortion. And there are hundreds of studies showing that abortion negatively influences women. And it's not just their mental health. It affects relationships. It affects parenting. The problems are just systemic.
How would you describe the methodological approach of this research in this article compared to the standards that other research
should uphold?
Yes, right.
Well, you do want to have initial initial decision to participate to be high. You know, you want to, if you ask a group of people, will they be in your study, you want to make sure at least 70 or 80% agree. Otherwise, you're getting a group that is maybe nicer, more likely to volunteer, may have more time, so they're going to be less representative of the population. So you want high initial consent to participate rates. You want to retain your sample. If you're losing more than, you know, if you're losing more than probably 20%, you're going to have skewed results. So that initial consent to participate, continuing involvement in the study to the end, substantive measures. You want the samples to be large enough. It's impossible to be representative if you have a small sample. In 2011, I published a meta-analysis in the British Journal of Psychiatry, which is one of the top journals in the world for psychiatry as well. It was amazing. They published my politically incorrect findings. But basically, in a meta-analysis, what you do, and it's considered a higher level of evidence than a single study, because I integrated information from 22 existing studies, and then from that data identified a summary effect. And so basically, this meta-analysis pulled information from almost 900,000 women, and I found that women who have an abortion compared to those who don't have an 81% increased risk for mental health problems. And so that study I use a lot in court when I do expert work, because it does trump a single study. It's information from 22 studies, and the larger studies are given more weight in the analysis. And I had inclusion criteria. I didn't incorporate any studies that had glaring methodological problems, and I made sure that I only used those that had 100 or more participants and studies that had controls for other kinds of variables, because you don't want to be comparing women who undergo an abortion at 19 to are 15 or any age to women who are, you know, delivering a wanted plan for baby, because their life situations are too different. And so when you see differences in the outcomes, we don't have confidence that it was the abortion per se. It could have been other things. It could have been abuse in the relationship. And so it is important to control for other demographic and situational variables. And so I only included studies that had those kinds of controls. And so, you know, all studies are not created equal, I guess, is sure. The bottom line. And now we know from this study and many others that have been published that the impact factor or the prestige of the journal doesn't mean a whole lot if the editors are motivated to only publish findings that will, fortify an agenda.
We only have about just about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. You conclude your critique with, the studies will be unattended by the average person, clinicians and science savvy alike, because the results simply do not align with the lived experiences of women. With just about a minute to elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, their claims are counter to what people in our culture are becoming increasingly aware of, and that's that millions of women are suffering in the aftermath of abortion. We do see those effects throughout the fabric of society. We see it in the parenting problems. We see it in substance abuse. We see it in relationship problems. And an abortion involves ending the life of a human being, and there are effects of that. It's not like getting your tooth pulled or any other simple, fast, elective surgery. It involves two human beings, and most women know that. They know that on some level, and it may not impact them in the immediate. It may impact them later when they have a child down the road. But there are so many testimonies. So many women are, you know, bravely coming forward and sharing the impact. It can't be squashed. You know, there's just been too much hurt, too much harm. The numbers are down. So we're down to under 1 million abortions each year. But at one point, it was 1.6 million abortions every year. All those women, year after year, they have families, they have friends. They, you know, so it's, we can't the truth is that abortion is not easy for many, many women. And that's a truth that no matter what the professional organizations, you know, try to do here and the journals, it can't be squashed anymore. It can't be hidden. It needs to be dealt with.
So certainly something to be mindful of as we hear about these studies in mainstream media. Don't just take it for what you hear on the cover of this story, but actually dig a little deeper and find out, is that research really accurate? Did it follow all the proper steps? What was their approach to
right.
it? Dr. Priscilla Coleman, Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Bowling Green State University, Bowling Green, Ohio. Dr. Coleman, thank you for being my guest today on Faith and Family.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Coming up in just a little bit, we'll revisit a conversation with Dr. Michelle Cortella, President of the American College of Pediatricians, the effects of pornography, particularly on children. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.